Hello, my name is Jim Armitage. I'm a professor of medicine at the University of Nebraska Medical Center, and today we'd like to share with you some of what I think are the most interesting things and most practical things for you to use as a clinician from the 12th International Conference on Malignant Lymphoma, often called the Lugano meeting, which is the biggest lymphoma meeting that occurs in the world. And it, as the name suggests, occurs in Lugano, Switzerland, and it occurs every other year. And I'm at that meeting right now. And what I would like to do is just highlight a few of the most practical papers from this meeting. There is one paper about CNS lymphoma that was provocative, I thought. The investigators from Italy took patients and divided them using their own system of high risk, low risk, into those that were unlikely to have CNS relapse, usually meningeal relapse for a patient treated systemically, or those that they thought were at high risk. And then they went back and looked at the patients and found an extremely interesting thing, and that is that those patients at high risk, if they got intrathecal therapy, still had an increased risk compared to low-risk patients of relapsing in the CNS. But those patients who received high-dose methotrexate or intermediate-dose methotrexate incorporated into the primary therapy had no one as CNS relapse. It's a very interesting idea. An alternate approach that was discussed was doing spinal taps on patients and doing flow studies and identifying those people who already by flow, you can find minimal disease in the spinal fluid, and then treating them specifically for CNS lymphoma. Of course, the problem here is that CNS relapse is really relatively rare, particularly in the era of rituximab. But if you can identify high-risk patients, it may be that something other than a few doses of intrathecal methotrexate would be a better approach. One other issue about CNS disease that was discussed at this meeting is a report using temsirolimus for patients who failed primary therapy, which would be usually high-dose methotrexate, perhaps with high-dose cytarabine, perhaps with radiotherapy. And they had an amazingly high response rate. Over half the patients who had failed standard upfront therapy still responded to temsirolimus. Interesting idea. Another issue that was addressed here is where radiotherapy fits today in the treatment of patients with lymphoma. You can hear people say in talks, and you can read in papers, that perhaps radiotherapy no longer has much of a place in treating patients with lymphoma. But there were some papers here that would certainly dispute that idea. There was long-term follow-up from the team at Princess Margaret Hospital in Toronto in patients with low-stage follicular lymphoma, which showed a 10-year freedom from relapse of 48%, including both stage 1 and stage 2 patients. That's a pretty good outcome. Everybody responded, almost everybody complete remission, and about half the patients remain in remission for over 10 years. So maybe radiotherapy isn't too old-fashioned for localized follicular lymphoma. And there were several papers that addressed the issue of radiotherapy as an adjunct in patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. There was a paper from the NCCN in the United States and another from the German Hodgkin Lymphoma Study Group that both, when they looked back on their data, found that there seemed to be an advantage to patients with bulky disease, even if they achieved a remission, if they got radiotherapy after treatment. And there was a very interesting paper from the team in Vancouver, which showed that patients who, at the end of therapy, had a negative PET scan did quite well, had a failure-free survival of about 3/4. Patients who had a positive PET scan at the end of therapy, if they received no more treatment, only 1/3 of them stayed well. However, those that got radiotherapy, 4 out of 5 stayed well. Now, this suggests that you can use a radiotherapy with an equivocal or positive PET scan at the end of treatment to a site of bulky mass, and the patient can do well. But it also makes you wonder, those patients who had negative PET scans, since their ultimate outcome was actually slightly worse than those who had a positive PET scan that got radiotherapy, if radiotherapy would have contributed there. So at least you shouldn't completely give up on the idea. There was data again about surveillance scanning presented here and showed once again that there's little evidence that surveillance scanning in patients with aggressive lymphoma contributes to outcome. That is, most patients would have been identified clinically, and little difference that there's an improvement in survival. And this applies to both Hodgkin lymphoma and aggressive non-Hodgkin's lymphomas. However, there was one interesting paper from Denmark where the investigators looked back at a large number of patients with both Hodgkin lymphoma and non-Hodgkin lymphoma, and they had a relatively higher number of people identified uniquely by surveillance imaging, where about a quarter of the relapses were identified by surveillance imaging. But they had a suggestion that the patients in the aggressive B-cell lymphoma, so mostly diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, that patients in that group might have done better if they were asymptomatic and had their disease discovered by surveillance imaging. At the moment, the overwhelming data would suggest that there's no place for surveillance imaging, and that's what I do. My colleagues and I don't do routine surveillance imaging. But I think this study and some other bits of data are enough of a hint that it really would be appropriate to identify very high-risk patients where we had effective salvage therapy like transplants for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma and do a randomized trial to answer this question about whether or not this study, that is a surveillance CT or PET CT, which costs a lot of money and scares patients and can lead to second malignancies, whether or not the net effect could be positive if we found the right group of patients. There were a couple of really interesting papers about things that we don't usually think about. One, from Worcester, Massachusetts, Chicago, and Duarte, looked at patients' exercise and diet and found that patients who had a diet high in fruits and vegetables were more likely to have follicular lymphomas that had a microenvironment that we know is associated with a good outcome. That is, perhaps what you're eating and somehow the other affects your immune system and improves its ability to respond to the tumor. Pretty interesting, something we haven't paid a lot of attention to. Another from the German high-grade lymphoma study group looked at patients from a large study of CHOP-R, and what they found was that people who were vitamin D deficient were more likely to relapse and lived less long than those who had adequate levels of vitamin D. There's been other bits of data about this, and this is actionable. Maybe we should all be checking our patients' vitamin D levels and replacing it routinely, and especially replacing it in people who have lower than normal values. Maybe it'd make a difference. Again, something that we haven't, as a group, paid a whole lot of attention to. And finally, I'll end with one last provocative thing. There have been studies presented at both ASCO and ASH over the last year that suggested that men don't do as well when given rituximab as women. And there are studies from Europe showing that men excrete rituximab more rapidly than women. Data presented here confirm that in data from the NCCN, that men had a less good outcome with rituximab than women, and also that people with a higher body surface area, that is, they got a higher dose of rituximab, seemed to do better. The German Hodgkin study group did a study that showed that men do excrete the rituximab. Their levels don't stay high as long as women, but that seemed to be largely in elderly men. And in fact, elderly men treated with aggressive regimens for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma that include rituximab had a poorer outcome than either younger men or women. So I don't know the answer to this yet. Should you be giving guys higher doses of rituximab? You probably wouldn't get it paid for. But it may well be that one of the reasons that men today don't do quite as well being treated for high-grade lymphomas is that the rituximab doesn't benefit them as much as it does women. Well, I want to thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed these highlights, and I hope you watch other highlights from the 12th ICML. And if you're interested to attend this really excellent meeting, you get another chance in 2 years.